From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Hello there. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Hi.
I didn't know if you were supposed to talk. How are you?
I'm doing well. You didn't put names on the script, so.
That is true.
So this is your fault.
I feel like you know your name.
I should.
Okay.
Yeah. I should by now.
Well, she's Megan. I'm Evan, and we've had a very busy week on the program, a busy week with elections, so it's just one of those sort of late weeks. I slept on a couch for a while here. We have very comfortable couches, I can report.
You can't just say that you slept on a couch and move on
in
that quickly.
In the lobby of WXXI's second floor, we have got very comfortable furniture.
During primary night. We were here very, very late
and I
primary
out.
Night.
And I passed. It was nice. It's nice to have nice furniture. And it's nice to start our weekly review with some news. Amazon is coming to Rochester. Probably actually not. They're probably not. But that's not stopping local leaders from trying to convince Amazon to bring their second headquarters to Rochester. Amazon wants American cities to offer proposals, and next year they'll make a choice. And the winning city gets Amazon's new HQ2 and up to 50,000 new jobs.
In this clip, you'll hear Vinny Esposito of the Finger Lakes Economic Development Council and Bob Duffy, president of the local Chamber of Commerce. We asked Duffy, is Rochester going to be knocked out of the running because Amazon wants mass transit, which Rochester doesn't have?
Well, I think it certainly is an issue that Amazon will look for. I think we can overcome that. It does give us cause to go back and look. We probably should have done a little better job previously putting more meat on the bone for that topic, but it still can come. You could be anywhere here in 15 or 20 minutes. You might not need mass transit like other cities because of our ability to get around. As we laughed before, there is no really big congestion. I've certainly worked out of New York City. I have a daughter, like Andrew, came back from Chicago, came back here to live. We offer things that I think compensate for that. In New York City, you need a subway system. In Rochester, you don't. We have Uber, we have Lyft, we have bike lanes. And I think the transit issues in terms of light rail or even the high-speed rail down the road, I mean, that's not going to happen in a short term anyway. But certainly with a Amazon coming in, it could expedite that. Amazon could be somebody would come in and be a big supporter of some of those amenities. But we have what it takes to get that done right now, hands down.
So this is where my ignorance on the proposal process comes in. I mean, Vinny Esposito, would Bezos and Amazon ever say, look, you've got so many things that line up, but we are going to want some more transit options. And would that be part of any kind of a negotiation, or is that not really likely? I mean, would they say, look, it's not going to happen overnight, but we need to know there's a plan in place for more transit options, and would it be considered?
Yeah, no, it certainly could be, and in a normal process, be part of a negotiation. This is obviously anything but normal, as we've alluded to, not only because it's so public and because it's so unique with Amazon and the way they've gone about this, but they also haven't actually put a lot of specifications in this proposal. Normally, when a company's looking to do this, they've done a lot more work and identified a lot more specificity as to what they're looking for. They're looking for out-of-the-box creative thinking. And so you're going to be hard-pressed if they really look at our community to find a place that has as many assets as we have and as many opportunities to paint the canvas the way they want to. Yes, we don't have a subway, but we have a downtown that is being reimagined right now. They could help define what that would look like and bring in other transportation options if they want. So it's all a question of how creative we can be to get a proposal in that makes sense and catches their eye and catches their imagination to put us on the map. And it gets into a lot of other things we haven't talked about with they prioritize things like sustainability and things that we may prioritize, which might be a regional approach that doesn't just include Rochester. So those are things that we're going to be considering in the next few weeks to overcome what you might see or what the New York Times might see as some of the shortcomings to identify why this is a great place to be for Amazon or any other tech company.
Now let's turn to one of the most distinguished guests we've ever had on the show. Thomas Pickering was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He was ambassador to Israel, then to Russia. Many assumed that President Clinton would name him Secretary of State. That job went to Madeleine Albright, but Pickering was one of her deputies.
And Ambassador Pickering is now part of a group of former diplomats and members of Congress called the Iran Project. He supports the Iran nuclear deal, and he helped to evaluate the terms as it came together in 2015. Now he's concerned that President Trump is going to scrap the nuclear deal, even though international inspectors say Iran is complying with the terms. He visited Rochester as part of his effort to make the case that the deal should stay in place.
The president literally has to sign a paper or approve the Secretary of State signing a paper that waives the continuation of U.S. sanctions against Iran in connection with the nuclear deal. And we are committed in the agreement with Iran, as long as Iran complies with the deal, to continue to waive the application of those specific sanctions and not to reconstruct them in a different guise. So the president doesn't have to sign. He doesn't literally have to find the question of compliance. But if he fails to waive the sanctions and everybody else believes Iran is in compliance, then it's quite clear we have violated the deal. And then there are two results from that. One is Iran could feel free, at least with respect to the United States, to go back to enriching uranium and doing it rapidly and at higher levels, which was what they were doing before the deal stopped them from doing it. Or they could say, well, the hell with the United States. We're going to make this deal because it's with five other countries, a continuing set of our relationships there, and we will do everything we can to isolate and marginalize and minimize the United States.
In which case, our authority and leadership position in the world would be
Absolutely.
Jeopardized, would it not?
It would be, but there would be other consequences of that marginalization of our leadership position. We would have less capacity to be influential, in my view, on important settlements in the Middle East, Syria, Israel, Palestine, and others. We would be separated in that regard from our major role in the international community, but even more importantly, if we then sought to compel others to comply by threatening them with the idea that if they do business with Iran, they will not be allowed to do business in dollars with the United States, which we could do. But that then puts our reserve currency of the world under the threat of being replaced. And increasingly, countries over the years said, why should we let the United States use its currency as a political weapon by keeping us out of doing trade with the United States if we don't do what the United States likes in a case like Iran, where the United States would have palpably and clearly violated the agreement? And so that would put in jeopardy the continuing importance to us of, in fact, being the world leader in the financial world and everything passing through the United States and New York, the financial capital, and all the things that you can think of here that would affect everything, including jobs.
So listeners, I want to make sure it's important that we understand, because this was rather new to me today as someone who's tried to follow from afar the Iran nuclear deal. The question for months has been, well, is Iran complying? What the ambassador is saying is, if Iran is in fact, according to inspectors, complying, and we are continuing to claim that they are not, we are the ones who are not complying.
That's right.
And there are possible serious consequences for that. Now, Ambassador Haley hasn't always, I don't think that she is directly rebuking or contradicting the president, but we've seen Rex Tillerson, we've seen Jim Mattis and others occasionally walk back, whether it was the president's comments about NATO and about articles of protection. And you know, there's been a lot of moments where his cabinet has occasionally seemed to soften the idea of something that he has presented to the public. How do you view Ambassador Haley's role there? And is that a delicate job for her?
Yes, it is. But rather than to do what you have just outlined, she gave a speech roughly a week ago at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, and it's worth reading. It's a carefully crafted speech, but in my view, it is full of exaggerations leading to misimpression. Hmm. I won't use the word L-I-E.
Okay.
I'm a diplomat.
I see.
So what she has said is for the president. The president can find that there is contravention of this agreement by Iran doing things they're not required to do in the agreement. So ballistic missile testing, which is not covered by the agreement, it covers nuclear only for good reason, because we did not feel that we could combine both and get the deal we needed on nuclear. And she also has said U.S. legislation, which requires some things, requires that the president find them in contravention if, in fact, they do things that are not in any way at all they are required to do under the agreement. This is complicated. And then she has said what the president would do is fail to waive the continuation of no sanctions on Iran, and fail to waive and therefore hold back any further sanctions, and then throw it to the Congress. And she said, and I'm not sure the basis for this, the Congress then has 60 days to act. So she's putting the president in a neutral position and putting it all on the back of the Congress, which is really pulling the president's chestnuts out of the fire, but in a way that does not escape all the consequences I just outlined with you on what would happen if we violate the agreement, because it would still be seen, as the other parties were quite sure, as a violation of the agreement. They have said so.
Could Ambassador Haley say, look, you might say, you might argue that ballistic missiles or any number of things is not technically in the language of the agreement, but Iran's actions violate the spirit of the agreement, that we have some discretion to make that determination?
With international treaties, we're bound by the letter. And in fact, we could go to the international court to settle a problem of interpretation rather than merely to make up a story that says there is something called the spirit of the agreement and Iran is not keeping it and we are. But that would be the way that kind of a problem would play out were we willing to go to the international court to fight it through. But I suspect, given the political dynamics behind this, there is still a large piece of effort to move.
Next, we turn to a dark chapter in our American history. Our guest was Heather Ann Thompson, a historian and the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the 1971 Attica prison uprising called Blood in the Water. Thompson spent years researching the uprising that resulted in 39 people dead. Time and time again, her research demonstrated that the government lied about who committed the violence during the uprising and what happened afterward.
In this clip, you'll hear Evan introducing a passage in the book about what President Nixon and others were saying about the prison uprising. Let's listen.
President Nixon was in the Oval Office discussing all that he had just learned about the retaking with fellow Republicans Bob Dole, Alexander Haig, and H.R. Haldeman. And quote, "They killed seven of the guards. A bloody business," Nixon told his aides. And worse, he went on, quote, "One of the guards had been castrated." Nixon was clear to the men assembled that, in his view, quote, "Rockefeller handled it well because, as the president put it, quote, you see, it's the black business. He had to do it," end quote. I don't know if there was a sentence in the book that landed more with that. And I know, as a white male, and we've had a lot of conversations about race, especially in the last year, there's a lot of listeners of color saying that should not surprise you. But there's still going to be some that really hurts. What do you think, Dr. Thompson?
Well, I think that's the importance of reading what actually took place. The fact is that the discussions we're having today about black lives not mattering, or about the way in which race so distorts and destroys our society, or more specifically racism, when you look at Attica, it's just laid bare. There's no two ways to interpret it. There's no alternative narrative you can provide for it. When you have the leaders of our country making clear that as long as the death toll at Attica was black folks, that it was okay. And frankly, even Nixon's understanding that the prisoners had killed the hostages, right, that this is what he's referring to. And so, you know, who cares if we went in and killed them? Even that was a lie. It's so interesting that the more people that I talked to doing this book, whether they were troopers or corrections officers or prisoners, the one stunning theme in the whole thing was that the state officials, the real puppeteers behind the whole thing, the elected officials, were the ones that at any point in time could have diverted this, could have changed it, could have even repaired it in its wake, and at every moment instead fueled the worst in people, stepped away from people in need, and literally turned a blind eye, first condoned and sanctioned, and then turned a blind eye to the repercussions, the trauma that these overwhelmingly black and brown prisoners, although not exclusively, there were white prisoners tortured as well, given all racial epithets as well, by the way, for having stood with black and brown prisoners. Those people were traumatized, you know, post-traumatic stress, and so were the guards. So it's the state officials. And that's why today, when we see stories of shootings that, you know, of unarmed people, or we hear about, you know, who's being indicted or who's not, our first question should be, who's got the power to make those decisions? And are they being transparent?
And I know there are some listeners, and maybe we'll hear from them in our second half hour, who are going to make the argument, well, these are prisoners. They're incarcerated for a reason. And we still have this national mentality, probably more than most industrialized or quote-unquote developed countries, right, that we look at people who are incarcerated as lesser than. That was clearly part of the goal of the state, wasn't it, to portray what happened, these 1,300 men as animals, mm-hmm. as lesser than, and deserving of what they got, as opposed to the reality of what was actually happening.
To those callers or listeners or just citizens who, though, would say that, well, when you do the crime, you do the time, one of the problems with that analysis is, number one, that in 1971, just like today, you'd be shocked at who's actually behind bars. You know, this idea that everyone's a serial killer or, you know, a rapist or a murderer, there were 19-year-olds in Attica there on parole violations. There were so many men there who had served their country in Vietnam and were in Attica for robberies committed because they were drug addicted coming back from Saigon. These were men who were mentally ill. These were men who suffered. And as a result of all of that, we can't assume, A, who's in prison. We can't make judgments wholesale about their worthiness to their humanity, because just because a jury has sentenced them, no jury has sentenced them to torture, to abuse, to the things that these men endured. So we as a country, we either believe that our system is there to protect and to make people better and whole. And if we do, then we cannot run our prisons as torture chambers. And so that's really the issue. It's not the issue of should people be serving time. We could have a different discussion about that. It's really about who are these people and how do we treat the human beings behind bars.
Let's close with one of our favorite stories we've had on the show. It comes from actress Andie MacDowell. We talked to the award-winning actress because she's coming to Rochester on September 29th to give the keynote address at the annual East House Hope and Recovery Luncheon. MacDowell will tell the story of her mother's alcohol addiction and how it impacted her family.
On Connections, MacDowell told a story about something else that kind of floored us. You see, like a lot of celebrities who make millions of dollars, Andie MacDowell moved into bigger and bigger houses. Eventually, she was living with her husband and children in a 10,000-square-foot mansion. But it was during a filming trip to South Africa that she realized how she felt about all of that.
I was working on a movie in Cape Town, and for some reason, I was really driven. I wanted to go to a church and hear singing. And I was working with one of my co-stars wanted me to come to his church, which was a mixed church. But for some reason, I had this idea that I just wanted to go to an all-black church because I just wanted to hear singing. And I don't know, it was a crazy thought of mine, but it worked. It did. It took me on a journey. When I was driving into Cape Town, I went by the shanty town, which is the most impoverished place you could imagine. And then they dropped me off at a hotel that looked like Disney, and it already was having an effect on me. Something had been stimulated, and I ended up going into the middle of that shanty town and going to a church, which it was an Episcopal church, which is what I grew up in. And going into the church, you know, you're driving through the town, it's all dirt roads, and they don't have infrastructure at all. And I went to this church, and everybody was just, they welcomed me, and it was the most beautiful experience. The service was in a tongue that I could, in their native language, and I couldn't understand a word. But boy, did I hear singing. I heard some amazing singing. And I just sit there, and it was like someone had turned on a water faucet. It was just liquid was coming out of my eyes during the whole service. And I ended up going to see these kids that had AIDS, and they put on a play about how in their community young girls were being raped because there was a thought going around that if you slept with a virgin, you would be cured from AIDS. So I was exposed, and they fed me in the church, and it was just like a transforming, open exposure to how hard life could be. And I had a lot of bathtubs at that time, and I just couldn't stand it anymore because just seeing so much poverty. I was already suffering with having a big house. I was trying to justify the house. I would have a lot of fundraisers in my house to justify having this big house. But it made me just made me uncomfortable. So now I live in a tiny house and I have two bathrooms. I feel much better. It's just me. That is just me. That was the overall effect. And I keep looking for how to continue my journey to give back to the world, because I see suffering and I want to be a participant. I want to be able to help other people.
It sounds like, you know, some level of celebrity and commercial success sort of inevitably society leads us into the bigger house and then the bigger house, but then something hits you and you go, that's not me. And it sounds like you're much more.
Yeah, it wasn't really. I just wasn't very comfortable. It didn't make me happy. I look back in hindsight and I talk to my kids about it, because they're much more simple people, really, too. We are thankful. It was a great house. It was a good life. And we're thankful for the memories, but it was too much for me. And I'm happier now in a smaller house and a simpler life. I think it suits me better. It was too much. I was uncomfortable, especially when I see so much poverty in the world. I don't know. I don't think anybody needs to have that much, honestly. But I don't want to make other people feel guilty if they do have it.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan, he's Evan. If you want to hear more about how comfortable the furniture is at WXXI, tune in next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.